The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Jason Freeman, and it is my pleasure to introduce tonight's authors, Christine Pride and Joe Piazza. Publishing industry veteran Christine Pride has held a variety of editorial positions at Doubleday, Simon & Schuster, Crown, among other publishing companies. In this capacity, she has championed and edited numerous New York Times best-selling memoirs and inspirational stories. Also a freelance editorial consultant, teacher, and coach, Pride writes the Race Matters column for the popular blog Cup of Joe, which brings us to our other author. A journalist, editor, and podcast host, Joe Piazza is also the author of seven novels, including Charlotte Walsh Likes to Win, If Nuns Ruled the World, and Fitness Junkie. Her writing has been published in a wide variety of places, including the Wall Street Journal, Marie Claire, and Slate. She formerly served as a managing editor for Yahoo Travel, the executive news director for the print and digital editions of In Touch Weekly, and she was the senior digital editor at Current TV. Pride and Piazza's first collaborative novel, and a Good Morning America book club pick, We Are Not Like Them, told the dual perspective story of two lifelong friends, one black and one white, whose bond is forever changed when the latter's police officer husband is involved in the shooting of an unarmed black teenager. Tonight, they join us with their follow-up novel, You Were Always Mine. In it, a black woman finds an abandoned white baby, setting up collisions with her own past and the child's mother. The great Jodi Picoult says of this novel, the work of Joe Piazza and Christine Pride sits squarely at the tender intersection of race, class, and ethics, wrapped in beautiful prose and a killer plot that keeps you turning the pages. And she also says this novel will spark one of many conversations America should be having. Tonight's conversation will be sparked by Alexandra O'Dare. She is a writer and actor and the author of Don't Call Me Home, a memoir. She was born in New York City to Mother Viva, a Warhol superstar, and father Michael, an award-winning filmmaker who directed Chelsea Girls with Andy Warhol. She's also a featured character in HBO's High Maintenance and has acted in the films of Wim Wenders and Jodie Foster, among others. So Philadelphia, let's give a warm greeting for tonight's guests.
Hello.
My friend Leslie just showed her, she did her nails for the book.
Oh, yes. I love it.
Gorgeous. And matching colors. I mean, of your outfit, too.
And the outfit, too. I know, yeah. I love it. I love everything about it.
Hi. I guess I'm used to being the other person. I'm like, okay, yeah, talk to me.
You're like,
I actually did sort of forget. I was
we,
like,
we could do that too. We've been talking to each other nonstop for five days now. We're like,
now,
does someone else want to talk?
I've got my notes. Thanks for coming, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. I was just saying back there, it's like, it's so exciting to be in the, the green room back there.
I know.
I've only been the audience.
You feel fancy. They have like all these pictures of every famous author of all time.
Yeah, it's nice back there.
And then we're like, we're here.
All right, so ladies, I think I can call you ladies.
Definitely.
Yes, absolutely. Great. Absolutely.
You're the co-authors extraordinaire, and I read both your books back to back.
Oh, that's interesting. I don't know if anyone else has read them back to back.
Yeah, it was really interesting. Yeah, and cool. And obviously a lot of, braided themes in there.
Definitely.
And I think the most obvious, which I'm going to get over the most obvious, because I feel like in your first book, you touched on the theme of sort of hiding the self and secrecy.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
And the first book is, to me, more clearly, but I could be wrong, the craft of it was like, okay, that seems obvious to me. So the first book is alternating chapters, Riley and Jen. And Jen is a white woman and Riley is a black woman. And they're best friends. And I won't give away anything else. Mm-hmm. But I imagined, obviously, you wrote Jen and you wrote Riley.
People do.
Yeah.
People do. Yeah. It's a common assumption.
Yes, I'm going to assume that. Yeah. And in the new book, the wonderful new book, it's really from the point of view of Cinnamon, a black mm-hmm. woman. And so I have a two-part question. Mm-hmm. You each wrote your own chapters, assuming correctly, in the mm-hmm. first book. Did you edit each other's chapters in the first book? In this book, how did you work that? Because the POV is Cinnamon, besides for Daisy, who's a white... There's one other POV, letters from Daisy, who is a white teenager.
Yes, yes.
So we actually did not split the writing in the first
book.
No.
But I think I love to unpack that assumption, right?
Yeah,
that
please.
It would be easier for Christine to write the black character and easier for me to write the white character. And our take on it was that race is a huge part of both of our characters' lives, but not every part. Mm-hmm. So both Jen, our white character, and Riley, our black character, they obviously are of a certain race, but they're also friends and sisters and daughters and career women and wives. And we could both speak to those things. And we felt like we would be doing the characters a real disservice if we didn't both contribute to them. And when we first started writing We Are Not Like Them, Christine was working full-time as an editor at Simon & Schuster. But she was my editor at Simon & Schuster. And then pulled me away to start writing books with her.
Which is so cool and rare, I think.
It is.
From the little
I
know of the publishing industry.
Yeah, it is pretty rare.
And so she was working full-time, and I was working full-time making podcasts and just having babies nonstop. So with our outline, we were like, okay, who has time to write a chapter? We couldn't tell if it was Riley's chapter or Jen's chapter. And then we trade back and forth, back and forth and over. We work in Google Docs.
Okay.
And so she would start editing, and then we'd send comments back and forth to each other. I don't think there's a sentence in either book that we didn't both touch at some point.
And we also really wanted the book to feel, particularly for the first book that is alternating chapters, so it's a very she said, kind of structure on purpose, but we wanted the book itself to feel coherent. We did not want it to feel like two different people wrote it, even though both their names are on the jacket, but we didn't want it to feel so disjointed in terms of like writing styles. We wanted the characters to be fully embodied so that we actually, disappeared behind them as writers and they were just the voices. Mm-hmm. And so that involved both of us being involved in both characters. But having said that, we chose to write this book together for a reason, and that is because we could bring our different experiences and perspectives to the table that are very different as a black woman and a white woman. This is for the first book, but also holds true for the second too. And so the parts that did need to, have our personal touches and our personal experiences thrown in, we were able to do that as well, because we always say that, there are conversations that I, as a black woman, hear that Joe would never hear, right? Yeah. In all black spaces and vice versa. And so the beauty of writing together was we could bring those conversations in. And that happens with our second book too, even though it's not exactly as 50-50 in terms of POV. Cinnamon really does own the story. She's the black woman with, as Alex said, there's some letters mixed in. But still, we made it coherent and then brought in, our different perspectives when it was warranted or when we had something specific to add.
Well, there's a fun connection with Cinnamon's name in Philadelphia. Should we
tell
that story?
Yes, the
local
connection,
Philadelphia connection. Yeah. So for We Are Not Like Them, it involves a police shooting of a black teenager. And for that book, we did a lot of reporting with the Philadelphia police. And one of the officers that we were interviewing was telling us this story about her. It was her first partner, I think.
I thought it was a CI. That's so funny. This is so many years ago.
Oh, I thought it was her first partner. I don't know. She was telling us a story, and she was like, and her name was Cinnamon. And we're like, we are obsessed with that name. And we're like, let's just file that away, and we'll use it in something. And then
we had already had the idea for this second book, and we sold both books actually at the same time. And so the premise, we knew we were going to do, but we hadn't named the character yet. And so, it's like characters' names are so hard, right?
It's like I was thinking a lot about
really
that.
It's really hard.
Yeah, I was wondering if you both would argue about characters' names or something, and actually, and then you say how, Cinnamon got her name, mm-hmm. which is interesting to bring to the next subject, because so much taking off on that theme of secrecy mm-hmm. and like fear of intimacy and shame of your past, which yeah, is, I think, a big theme
of the book.
Yeah. And so Cinnamon is living in some ways with her husband, Jason. I'm going to say living a lie, but she's not really, because there is really love there and they have a real thing, but she's not even shared with her own husband the traumas of her past. Mm-hmm. And her name comes up in that. So she mm-hmm. got her, I think, her mother lost a bet with a stripper, mm-hmm. or was it, mm-hmm. am I correct with that?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And so you kind of learn that, you know, you get little clues along the way of how, what Cinnamon's past was, how she became who she was. And I wonder if you two, like, were there ever, did you ever have to fight for things that each of you wanted within the character, even within Daisy's life, within Jason's life, within Cinnamon's life, that one of you felt certain about and the other of you didn't, and vice versa?
Yeah, I mean, less so in this book than I think even the last book. I think our collaborative, I mean, it's interesting because this question dovetails in terms of our both storytelling and our collaboration dynamic, right? And so I think in this book, there's much more of, you know, if you can make a case for this, like, it's just about the story. So we don't really disagree so much as it is, like,
tell me why you want
this.
Yeah,
tell me why you want this. Like, tell me why this is important. And, like, oh, yeah, that makes sense. That, it, you know, makes sense in terms of the for the sake of the story. And so that is how we've, I mean, resolved makes it sound like it's coming on for the other side of conflict. Mm-hmm. But that's how we, you know, sort of manage the big decisions in the book. But I think, you know, it's interesting that one of the things we had, I guess, a discussion about was, this is not giving too much away, we're really going to try to, like, not do any spoilers.
We're trying to not so spoil. Bad with spoilers.
And now she really is. She's like, and so then in the end.
Yeah. I don't know. No. I'm just like, on page 134.
Yeah. So I'll elbow her if she's getting close. But our character Daisy, who's 19 years old and finds herself, you know, unexpectedly pregnant, and it is obviously a very harrowing and dramatic situation for her to find herself in. But in delving with her backstory, you know, she has big dreams for herself. And so early on in the book, we were trying to decide, you know, what these dreams would be. And she comes, you know, from a very, you know, small rural town in the South. You know, Joe was like, she wants to be a pilot.
From the very beginning.
I was really interested in that.
I was like, I want her to be a pilot.
Yeah, and I was like, is this too much? Does she want to be a pilot? Does this feel... And it's interesting in even thinking about, like, that kind of thought process. I had to interrogate, you know, sort of my own biases there, right? Like, why shouldn't she want to be a pilot, right? Like, everybody is allowed to have whatever dreams they want to have from wherever, you know, vantage point they're starting from. And so... You know, it was like, why not that? But I think it's interesting to you know, think about, even we had the power to create our characters' dreams. Like, that's a lot of power. And, you know, why did I feel initially, like, limited in that, right? Like, that is something to think about in and of itself.
That's a really good scene in the book, too. I thought, I was imagining both of you. Actually, that's not true. When I read it, I just was reading it. I was like, oh, that seems totally legit. And then when I had to go back with my critical mind through the book for this night, I was thinking about that and how it actually seems very true. I don't know why. It just seemed like, oh, yeah, I can really see that.
Yeah. And now it does. Because right. now she's a person.
Now she's a person.
Yeah, right, exactly.
And that said, when the character Cinnamon... When she's chatting with Daisy on this park bench and they're getting, and they don't know anything about each other, they just happen to be, they have these strange similarities, and they're two basically lonely women. One's a really young woman, and one is Cinnamon, who's not as young. And
we're very vague.
I like that. Not as young.
I know. I'm like, not as young.
Less young.
We are all not as young.
That's a good way. We are all not as young
as a teenager. Yeah.
But when somebody says to me, how old are you? I'm going to be like, not as young.
Not as young. Not as young as Daisy.
My new answer.
Yeah.
I was young, and now I'm not as
young. Now I'm not as young. I am much older than that now, which I think is a Bob Dylan line. So Cinnamon actually then checks herself with her own biases. And so, because Cinnamon thinks, ugh, like, you know, I'm exaggerating now, but basically, oh, you're never going to be a pilot. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's not exactly the literal thing, but that's the vibe of the paragraph. And then that brings Cinnamon to, you know, kind of muse on the microaggressions that she has had to deal with. And I think the points of the book with that you deal with microaggressions. Mm-hmm. I mean, macroaggressions, of course, major of course, too. Yeah. But so many interesting microaggressions that also Jason's character, I found really interesting and so subtle and nuanced, the way Jason talks about going fishing with his boyfriends who are white.
Yeah.
And these subtle microaggressions that his very close white friends give off. And yeah, I just would like to hear more of that because, you know, obviously you're white, so I'm assuming you're not getting those kind of microaggressions. Mm-hmm. Do you feel, Christine, like you, that's what you brought to the table, that you, and even with Jason, both of you, I'm sure you brought a lot to Jason's character for sure, but tell me about that process.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because in the, Jason is Cinnamon's husband, and in our
story. He's everyone's least favorite character in the
book.
He's
my favorite character.
Or as my best friend described him, triggering.
So to me, making me horny.
Hey, you know what? Jason's hot.
Okay? Yeah, we've really all decided that Jason's hot.
Yeah, he's definitely hot.
But I think in the scene that you're talking about in particular, he, and I'm going to forget the joke / microaggression we put in there, where Jason is going deep sea fishing with some of his white dude friends. Yeah, and
Bruce Gies.
I think what we were trying to do there, and it's, you know, interesting, we really try so hard with like the subtleties and the gray areas in our books, and particularly when it comes to race, which can be so obviously complicated and fraught, and interracial friendships. So Jason has these interracial friendships, and the way that comes up is there's, you know, they're going deep sea fishing, and there's a joke about, Jason makes a joke about one of his friends maybe referencing the Middle Passage because they're out deep sea fishing.
Yeah, that was really funny, but dark.
Yeah. And I think that that's the kiss. It's like, can you, when you can get to the point with your close friends where you can joke about certain topics, and obviously this has to be a safe space and, you know, there's trust between you two and so forth, but, you know, we try to turn to really dive into these, you know, intimate interactions between people, because it's very different if, you know, a stranger or, you know, a coworker says something that can be a microaggression versus a close friend can say something and you have the familiarity, it's a joke. And it could be this actually the same actual comment, right? And so much about that is the trust and the rapport that you have with somebody. And that's the kind of layers that we're, you know, digging into.
And also different kinds of microaggressions, which we wanted to dig into. I love that when you first brought up Jason, I thought you were going to talk about when he's at his construction site, he's building a restaurant, and he starts speaking
the name of the restaurant.
The Ruins.
The Ruins. The Ruins. And he puts on his like boss man voice with his workers who are from Mexico. And so Jason has these kind of aggressions towards his workers, but then there's also slights toward Daisy, who is a bigger girl, and so there's slights about her weight, and there's slights about how big she is, and also our character Lucia, whose family is from Puerto Rico, and
who's married to a Jewish man.
And who's
so
married
we really
to a Jewish
have a
man.
Very,
yeah. Well,
yeah.
But then also like about motherhood.
And about motherhood,
it's like,
too.
So Cinnamon experiences them not necessarily as a black woman, but as a woman in her 30s without children. And people say things to her, which Christine has also heard because she is child-free by choice. You know, well, why can't you have children? Things like that. These are all microaggressions that we wanted to put in the book so that people would think about them, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and it works really well. And again, because I read the two books back to back, I really, you know, I would start to almost conflate them because you touch on it with Jen and Riley from the first book. They're best of friends, but Jen will sometimes make a joke that Riley secretly feels is a bit of a microaggression. And so, and that's also what I mean about the obfuscation of self that's you're touching on even in the first book.
Totally.
Because Riley isn't at, and you know, do we ever do this? And this is the question of both books, like, do we ever fully reveal ourselves?
Yeah.
And so I think Jen and Riley do, you know, very well reveal themselves to each other, and they work through that, but there's still these little hidden things. But, and then the second book, the you know, between Jason and Cinnamon truly are not revealing themselves, and that, you know, comes to a head at some point. And there's this one, you know, thing that Cinnamon says, where she says, lion requires an exhausting vigilance, mm-hmm. you know?
And you wrote that line. That's a great line.
Yeah, nice line. And I've definitely experienced that, you know, even in like micro lies, you know, mm-hmm. that you might have
baby
to
lies.
Hold up to.
Yeah.
You're like, ooh, shit, you know, like.
Also the lie where you're like, I can't go on Friday night, right? And whatever you make up,
like,
and then you're
shit,
like, oh, I forgot I said
restaurant.
I had COVID.
Yeah, it really is. And so, yeah, and is it
just me?
No, not just you. Yeah, and I was like, you know, is it possible to live fully in truth? I don't know. You know, yeah. I don't have an answer for that. But
no,
I
don't think it is.
No. Yeah, I agree.
I think it's something we aspire to, and I think it's an interesting theme that has, I mean, almost subconsciously really emerged in both of these books. Yeah. But, it really is there, which is, you know, how we can only be our, have the kind of really deep, authentic relationships we want when we show up as our true selves, right? And Jen and Riley were craving that, and, you know, Cinnamon is craving that in her life. And yet, how hard it is to show up as our true selves. And I think for Cinnamon's case in particular, it's, you know, there's so much shame involved when you are outside whatever the quote mainstream is, right? When you don't feel like you have a conventional family or nuclear family or, you know, all these trappings that we say this is quote normal, and I'm using aggressive quotes, but this is normal and everything
and you use
else.
Aggressive quotes. They don't go like they go
I
like
know.
This.
I'm like the aggressive quotes. And I don't have a boom mic to hold up, but yeah. Aggressive quotes. But, you know, so even though there shouldn't be the shame there, obviously, I think we all know that, and Cinnamon does, you know, to some degree know that too, and there's an added layer for her as a Black woman, and, you know, moving through the world where she, you know, she already is heaped with all these prejudices and stereotypes, and, you know, she doesn't want to be a statistic or, you know, a trope, right? Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of reasons for her to kind of both hide who she is, but even block off the trauma of what she experienced. And part of her emotional journey is coming to terms with that, right? And I think that that's what we want to encourage people to do and to see our characters do it, which was, this was my past or this is what I experienced, but this is, you know, not the limits of who I am, or this doesn't define who I am. And honestly, this is not something I had a lot of control over. And we have so much shame about things we have no control over, namely our parents or, you know, or where we're born and our financial situation, you know, that we're born into. We have no control over that. And yet there's so much shame and stigma around it.
Yeah. And I think you touched what you were just saying. You touched on this point in that, like, you know, she says even to Jason, or thinks it, that did, you know, she fall in love with the version of herself, you know?
Yeah. That I mean, she how was, many of us have done that?
That she was just like the Jason
saw
on her.
We date the person because, like, they see us as we want to be seen.
And then when it kind of blows up is when, you know, when she tries to present this very small white child to Jason is like, I'm going to raise this baby. Mm-hmm. And Jason feels very strongly that's not going to happen as a Black. And then it's a very like poignant section. I was going to have you read, but maybe it's not right now. I don't know.
We can summarize.
Okay.
Yes. Summarize it.
And I'm going to have you ruminate on that bit, but it's a very amazing section where Jason says why he wouldn't want to go to the playground with a white baby, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And it's a couple of pages. Great. But he can't empathize with Cinnamon, and that's that double-edged sword of like self-obfuscation because she's never revealed to him who she really is. So he's like, why would you ever want to do this?
Where is this coming from?
Yeah, we as the reader know exactly why she wants to do it. And it's this moment of like, you know, spine-chilling truth where you're like, oh, if she had only revealed herself to him, now he could support her in this.
Yeah, I know. It's fascinating too. And I mean, we wanted to show all the reasons why Cinnamon would find herself in this relationship with Jason, right? I mean, as Joe just said, it's very seductive when you see somebody who has kind of the opposite characteristics that you have in a way and then sees you in a certain way, right?
You feel chosen.
You feel chosen and you feel like, you know, I can kind of hitch my wagon to this person you know, kind of go along to get along, and they're going to be my ticket or path to, you know, XYZ life. And that is, you know, really a seductive promise until you come up against this idea of, oh, wait a minute, you know, there are some limitations there.
In
there. Yeah. And the baby, Cinnamon finding this baby in this case.
As a black woman who finds a white baby. Just because people haven't read it.
Yet. Right.
Yeah. Right, yes. Yeah.
This is, that is the key part of it. This is the catalyst that forces her to reexamine this relationship. Mm-hmm.
But the pages you're talking about mm-hmm. where Jason says, I'm a black man and I don't want this white baby. Mm-hmm. I've had a lot of friends read this book before it came out. A lot of white friends read this book and they're like, oh, wow. Until I read those pages, I didn't get the consequences mm-hmm. that were here. And he says to Cinnamon, essentially, you can take this little white, blonde-haired, blue-eyed baby to the playground and people are just going to think you're her nanny mm-hmm. and that's okay. And I will be there with her and they will think I am a crime. And that stopped a lot of my friends in their tracks. They're like, I did not see it like that. Yeah. We're like, well, that's the point of this book.
And because we really, we don't see that very often, right? No. We're more used to seeing a white woman, a white man with a black baby.
Yeah. All the time, this was often in pop culture. Yeah, this was our intent, yeah.
To turn it on its head, and I would even say, you know, it's not. I mean, when Joe said it's okay, meaning it's not necessarily dangerous, yeah. and yet, I mean, relative to what Jason would experience, if you know, okay, mm-hmm. this baby is with a nanny, like you know, I'm gonna, which is not.
We're not calling the police, right?
Yeah,
now.
We're not calling the police, except that, you know, that does happen, right? I mean, it's so rare that we see circumstances where black families or black women or black parents are raising a white child. I mean, like, you know, a solar eclipse rare. Mm-hmm. But when that does happen, you know, it is actually dangerous for both parties. Like in this case, it's probably more dangerous for Jason, but, you know, it is, you're constantly under surveillance and you're constantly judged and questioned and, you know, why are you with this child in a way that would never happen in the reverse? And that's a real, I mean, it's a very simple premise that we started with, right? Mm-hmm. What happens, let's say, if a person finds an abandoned white baby or just an abandoned baby. Like that's dramatic. Yeah. But once you do a skin tone switch and that's all you're doing, like changing mm-hmm. the skin tones of the people involved in the scenario, just a simple reverse, and it is a dramatically different set of circumstances. And how telling is that? And what does that say about our society?
And each time that comes up in each scene, like when the first time Cinnamon says, well, I found this baby, you know, and her friend's like, you know, oh, you have to take care of that baby. Don't bring it to the police. No way. And then Cinnamon says, it's a white baby. And they're like, oh, my God, get rid of that. You know,
the assumptions. It's really fascinating.
Well, no, we've seen how that shift has impacted readers, too. And we like to talk about this because we think it's really important. You know, there have been comments on the book so far, and it's only been in the world for like 72 hours at this point. It's crazy.
It's all a blur.
Yeah, it really is all a blur. But you know, people saying things like, what Cinnamon did is illegal. I can't even continue the book because you know she shouldn't be doing this. And legality with children varies by state by state, but pretty much she's not doing anything.
But also, as Joe points out, characters are allowed to do illegal things.
Characters are also allowed to do illegal things.
I mean, there are so many books about serial killers that if everybody stopped reading after the first murder, it would really be,
you know. Let's talk about Crime and Punishment.
Ruin a genre.
Let's talk about Dostoevsky, okay? But the code for that we would really like to throw out there is, would you think what she was doing was so illegal that you couldn't continue if it was a white woman who found a brown baby or a white woman who even found a white baby in the park? And we really think that there is just a very
double standard.
Yeah, big double standard.
And it brings out the reader's implicit biases in a major way.
Which is what we want to do, though. Like, that's great. You know, intentional.
I mean, we don't want them to put the book down and then give us a shitty rating on Goodreads.
That's true. We do not want that.
Like, I prefer that didn't happen. But yeah. Still, when people, and we're trying to say this as much as possible, when people are uncomfortable, we're like, all right, ask yourself why. Mm-hmm. What is making you uncomfortable? We believe fiction should make you uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm. No, and it is. I think it brings up two things. One, it's just the inherent implicit bias of
which
humans.
No one wants to talk about. Yeah.
I mean, and I do think that now it's slightly, not that the implicit bias is better, but I think there is a more opening, even that we know this word. That we even know this word.
Totally.
We know the word microaggression. 100%. We know the word implicit bias. But there's also an issue, I think, with the modern, maybe social mediated brain mm-hmm. of consumers of content, where they really confuse character with actual intention, right? Yep. So even when I dabbled on my own, which I don't do, Goodreads or whatever, mm-hmm. it's like people are like,
"Oh, did you look?"
I did.
Oh, yeah. Fuck. Yeah. How's that?
I guess you're not supposed to, but yeah,
I did. I know I'm not supposed to. I'm 10
it's
books
really
in.
People are crazy,
they're and so they're like, nuts there.
And
yeah.
they're basically like, you know, oh, this. You know, these parents are crazy. I'm not reading it. I'm like, okay, well, they're actual people.
Like, this is a memoir.
This is a memoir.
And I'm like, she's like, they're actually
yes,
my mom and dad.
The book is literally so. About how they're crazy. So, yeah. okay.
But you can't respond to Goodreads readers because it's
no,
like talking
definitely.
To the crazy person
oh, yeah,
on
no,
the street.
I
like they're
going to the
throw
urge.
Like feces in your face.
Yeah, I know, because I'm such a neophyte. I had the urge to be like, well, Jason, I guess you said you stopped reading it, but you clearly couldn't put it back down because you finished reading it, motherfucker.
Boom. And,
but then I was like, oh, yeah, I guess you're not supposed to respond, you know? But yeah, so I think there is an issue with our, and I'm not even like saying this in a condescending way. I actually think our brains
no,
are
I think
mutating
it's true.
In a strange way.
100%. Totally.
Well, I think yeah. it's a big, you know, problem or challenge in publishing in general. And I worked in publishing, you know, for
Christine
20 years.
Worked, you said 20. You never say 20.
I know.
You're like,
well,
you usually
I
say a long time.
That's what am I saying? I'm not as
you're
young.
Not as,
yeah,
not as
I'm
young.
Young
as...
I'm not as young.
Yeah. Not as young. Yeah. Yeah. Not as young.
It's been a few
yeah.
years. You're right. I think. Beep, yeah. beep,
beep, beep. Beep.
In
beep.
The, for the YouTube version, let's cut that out.
I've worked in many publishing houses.
I've worked in many. A long time publishing vet. Mm-hmm. That's my
yes.
usual euphemism. But there is this idea that, you know, readers conflate... you know, the author's morality or worldview
yes.
mm-hmm. with the characters, right?
Yep.
And I mean, if we had, and we ran up against this in our first book too, where we wanted to be very clear that we weren't writing a morality tale, that we had mm-hmm. a lot of, this wasn't an agenda-driven book where we were coming with a, you know, a strong, you know, viewpoint about policing in America, and then you mm-hmm. read this, like, tale that just
and then a liberal fairy tale yeah. where everyone is very woke at the end
yeah,
of it.
And yeah, and there was some happy ending with the Supreme Court being, you yeah. know, stacked
no.
with Democrats or something.
That didn't fucking happen.
Yeah, it sure did not. So, you know, we run out, the types of books that we want to write, have written, and want to continue to write will always run up against that wall of,
yeah.
you know, sort of what is the reality that we're dealing with, particularly with hot button issues mm-hmm. of, like race, and then what is realistic for our characters, both white and black, and their experiences and how they portray those experiences. And the characters just have to get to be the characters without getting it to be a larger statement mm-hmm. on, you know, society with every interaction, right?
That's great.
Or our intentions with every yeah. interaction.
But I think with the rise of identity politics, too, there's a lot of identity things in almost everything we do, and even in
yeah.
reading. It's like, I want a book to agree with everything I agree
mm-hmm.
with.
Right. And I hope you keep, I think it's wonderful and amazing that you're
That's
doing what
thing.
You're doing.
Yeah.
So I got the 5-minute mark, but I do want to, and my last
so
question, I know
that
it's too
so
fast.
I mean,
on a really like dark and fucked up note before we have audience
perfect
questions.
Ending.
Oh,
perfect ending.
We yeah. love a dark and fucked up note.
I want to
yes.
know about Derek, who is the like white supremacist
the white
character.
Supremacist. Yeah.
And I guess like, was he easy to sketch? Did you base him on anyone you know? Was it just like, I know this fucking dude and we'll write him? Because he actually is very particular
mm-hmm.
and nuanced, and he's a real person. But yeah, that's my, like, that's where I want to
yeah.
end before
yeah.
we take
yeah, perfect.
Yeah.
That's
yeah,
let's
white end supremacy. Guys, let's end on
so,
white supremacy and think about your questions.
Yeah,
okay?
yeah.
yeah.
No, but I mean, I think it's interesting you say that because it is a dovetailing with, you know, what we're talking about where we don't want to write morality tales, and it's hard when you want to do well-rounded characters that have a lot of complexity. That is, you know, easier when it's your main characters that you do mm-hmm. identify with and, you know, adore. It is harder with the characters that you don't identify with. Mm-hmm. You know, if you've all read our first book, you know, we have a character, Matt, who is...
He's the only character in the first book that, like, actually
problematic.
Sucks. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
In a
Everyone
lot of
else
ways.
Has, like, shades
it's
of
true.
Gray
yeah.
and moments where you're like, I like you, but Matt does suck.
Yeah. yeah.
But it's hard to write a character like Derek where... we didn't want him to be a caricature. Like, you have to come to the table mm-hmm. with even empathy for your villainous characters mm-hmm. to some degree. Otherwise, they're just going to seem like cartoons or, you know.
Which we see a lot of.
Which we see a lot of. And so that is, you know,
I
a
felt
challenge
that you did
to
that.
Do.
Well, he was a caricature at first.
He
remember?
Was a caricature.
Like,
we had to really work.
The first draft, he really was. And even the second draft. And the gift that Christine and I have of having two of us is we can do one thing that a single author cannot do. And I've written a lot of books by myself. Christine has her first novel by herself coming out in 2 years
now? Bravo. I don't know.
What someday. And we get to read our books out loud to each other, which is really awesome because no one loves your book as much as you do. And I've tried to make Nick Astor read my books out loud with me. And he falls asleep halfway. Maybe you don't fall. You're not listening.
Which is not a testament to the book. It is the testament to they have 10 children.
Loud. You don't love the out loud, but we love the out loud.
We do love the out loud.
I think you recognize character a lot when you read it out loud.
Totally. And
so with Derek, I'm so glad you brought him up because that was a moment where we're like, nope.
He doesn't sound right.
So you had to go a couple rounds.
Yes. We had to go a couple rounds.
Yes, definitely.
And, you know, also with people who are kind of evil in the world, they don't always appear evil.
Right,
and
exactly.
So, yeah. he's a chameleon. He can be a lot of different things.
And when he comes into court, so, you know, you're like, you get it. Like, he's the grandpa.
He's the grandpa, yeah. But Derek is also one thing. I was less worried about Derek and more worried about Barbara, the grandmother. I'm like, I wanted to give her the moment and her the empathy. But it's tough. Like, caricature, especially when you're writing about race and the things that we're writing about.
It gets hard,
It gets hard, and we never want to do it.
Totally. It really seems hard. I mean, it's hard enough. Yeah, I mean, just from my experience, you know, writing about the things I really know well about. So I was really imagining you both going through that process, and the collaborative process is truly inspirational. It's amazing that you can do that. It's like, I think that's such a skill in life, and it's beautiful. I really, really am impressed and inspired by that.
Oh,
well,
thank you.
I mean, it seems easy now, but it was so fucking hard.
I'm sure. Yeah. My God, it seems really hard. Yeah.
I just thought, well, like an observation. I thought it was interesting. We started talking about assumptions, and I was one of many people that assumed for your first book, you wrote the different characters respectively that everyone. Mm-hmm. So I was just thinking, how interesting that we started out. Like, assumptions has been a theme.
Even
thinking about it critically, like, wow, getting confronted with that. I guess my question is, I have a lot of questions, but I won't ask them because of spoilers. Do you each have a favorite line of the book?
That's a really good question.
Some of the lines are so rich.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, great question.
It's so hard to answer because
we don't remember
100
any,
pages into the new book together.
Yeah. It's like barely in your...
Yeah. And so, but I have to say the one that Alex read, that Christine wrote, is one of my favorite lines. I love that. I really do.
I like that we did a podcast recently, a podcast interview, and the interviewer read from the opening.
Oh, yeah. Let's grab that.
I do that.
And they had a really good podcast voice, too. It was so Ira Glass.
Oh, yeah. The opening, the first letter. Yeah. So good.
Yeah. It was chapter one.
You know, I love the first line of this book. Like, I'm a sucker for a good first line of a book. And Christine is very good at a lot of things. But let me tell you. She has named all of our books, and she has come up with the name.
I'm good at titles and first lines.
Titles and first lines. But she's come up with all of them while she's in the shower, and I just imagine her sopping wet, running out of the shower, and texting me.
Because that's happened twice.
This is it.
And first I have to go to Amazon. I'm like, has anybody titled a book this? Yeah.
The last line of the book, I'm going to do that just so you can bring, is the title of
the
book.
Yeah.
And that I was really like.
Yeah, it's nice when it comes.
But I like the first line, and I think that this will resonate with a lot of women of a certain age.
that are not as young as they were.
Not as young as they once were.
Not as young as you.
I think that's a Toby Keith line. Yeah. Not as young as I once was.
Read it, because I don't remember it.
Okay. So the first line of chapter one is, Cinnamon Haynes can't remember when she stopped wanting things in life. And I think we've all had at least, if not that existential crisis, we've had that moment, right? Like, when was the last time I pushed myself or I, you know, thought about stepping out of my comfort zone or I reached bigger than, you know, I thought I could. And that is something that she really wrestles with in this book.
Also, what do I deserve?
Yeah, that's so true. And I can't help but answer one myself because I think when Jason, I know I'm obsessed with him.
I love how obsessed you are with Jason. It brings
Cinnamon,
me so much joy.
When Cinnamon reveals, when it's revealed that her past is nothing, you know, like what she told him it was. He calls her a con artist, and I think that word was woo, you know, like that was like a real shiv in the side.
Right. Or it's like when, you know, a character makes reference to Daisy's decision. Daisy is the 19-year-old mother and calls her a monster. Like what kind of monster would leave their baby?
Their child. But those words, the word choice,
right? Yeah. It's like people have these extreme, you know, kind of reactions to things and you know, have these extreme judgments that feel realistic, and our characters have them, but we also want people to interrogate why they have them and why they feel like they have the right to have them, right? Like, who are you to judge anybody else's choices in this life period?
Yeah, I mean, what makes a monster, and also what makes a mother? Mm-hmm. And so, yes, someone says, what kind of monster leaves a baby? Because Daisy does abandon her newborn baby. But she is a desperate child, and she's a desperate child with no other options, and desperate people make desperate decisions. And especially, we finished this book before Roe v. Wade got overturned. And we had the idea for this book in 2018 when it didn't look like that would ever happen. And I think it's more poignant now, mostly just no matter which side you're on, to think about, like, what would you do in this character's shoes? Mm-hmm. And it's not so easy as it's like, just give the baby up for adoption or just get an abortion. Daisy is 19 years old. She is broke. She has no family. She has no friends. She has no even idea how she would give a baby up for adoption or how she would get an abortion. She has no health insurance. And so she is just stuck.
You handled that really well. Yeah, that felt very believable. We didn't even dabble into the motherhood thing, but I think, did you have a question?
Somebody's going to have a question about motherhood, I know.
Does anybody have a question about motherhood?
Just someone like else. In general.
We've got some mothers in the audience.
What,
we've got
what,
some
how
babies.
Do you feel about
we've
it?
Got two babies in the audience right now.
I know.
Mine is asleep. Bon, is yours asleep? Oh, good, good, good.
Two sleeping
well,
babies.
Well, that is the thing. Like, that's what, you know, I think at the end, I don't think I'm giving away anything, but not at the end, just throughout the whole book, you realize that is when Cinnamon says, I'm choosing myself, you know?
Yeah, I love that line too.
Yeah,
so yeah that's another one of our favorite lines. Yeah, I'm choosing
So she, you know, basically by choosing what she chooses, not to give it away and not something else, it's really for her, she realizes. And, you know, I think that that's the big, you know, meta question. Like, some of us do choose the child and you give up other things, and some of us are going to choose ourselves in a literal way. Not that, you know, I don't at all think it's selfish not to have children, but you're choosing your writing perhaps over each other, because you certainly, although Joe's the only person I know who writes three books at the same time and has three kids. And I think it's quite hard to write and have children at the same time.
Or to write and have no children at the same time. Also hard.
I have a truly excellent support system. Could you just stand up, Nick Astor?
Round of applause for Nick Astor.
Woo, Nick Astor!
But I mean, part of what we wanted to explore too is this ambivalence about motherhood. We see so many stories that sort of pick up after the baby is here. I mean, there's countless motherhood memoirs. There's countless stories about, you know, sort of navigating motherhood and the joys of motherhood and the scary mommy, drunk mommy books that we had a whole slate of. You know, I mean, there's a whole genre.
Scary mommy.
Yeah,
right here.
We don't have a lot of books about the before, the inflection point, the ambivalence about having children, the you know, choices that you have to make, the complexities of those choices, where it's not as simple as, you know, it was like the perfect time to have a baby and not a partner, and you know, the baby's going to be here in spring because, you know, the cherry blossoms will be here, and et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
It's like that. I mean, we so often veer towards the idealized version, where most of the time it's like
95%
this is
going to
be hard.
Mothers.
I don't have any money. Does my partner
I'm
want this? Are we
this.
On board?
I'm
my job? Do I have enough maternity leave? Do I have enough insurance? You know, I mean, we wanted to get into those kind of complexities, which is actually the reality and not, you know, the fantasy.
Yeah, I mean, pop culture and even literature skews towards privileged motherhood. And I think that's because a lot of authors for the majority of human history were privileged individuals. And, you know, the people that write TV shows are also privileged individuals. And that's not the reality. And we wanted to show two women who chose very different paths regarding motherhood, who had no options.
Yeah, I really appreciate that because I find it very frustrating to only see the other representation of the
mother.
Or they
only see one type of story, period, right? Yeah. Like, in so much of pop culture, it is just, like, one type of story, the white savior narrative or the happy mother narrative or the, you know, I mean, we just keep seeing the same thing.
Make so many mistakes, and then we get engaged narrative.
Or the happy ending narrative. You know, the heteronormative, we're going to, you know, walk down the aisle narrative. And so we're constantly just trying to push against that, both in our stories and by publishing the stories themselves, right? That these kind of stories exist that tell a different, you know, come at it from a different angle.
And I think coming at it in terms of, and I hate to use like publishing terms, like commercial fiction instead of literary fiction. We want these books to
accessible, relatable
stories, right?
Yeah, it really feels
I know
like
we've
that,
talked a lot about trauma today, but it really is a beach read. So.
Yeah, it actually really is.
If you
want
to read it on the beach, you totally can.
You'll be gently traumatized on the beach, but then just take a swim.
That's what these flowers are trying to indicate right here.
It looks beautiful on your beachy picture, but you might cry a little bit.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
You'll definitely cry a little, that's for sure. But it's good to cry on
but
the
in
beach.
A good way.
In a good way. It's good.
My suitcase, my God, the breaking news.
Thank you, everyone, for following the saga of my suitcase. For those of you who don't follow me on Instagram, my husband...
Nick wants to defend himself.
My husband lost my book tour suitcase on Amtrak on Monday. I know. Do you hear the collective gasp go up? So I was lucky enough that people brought clothes to all of my book tour events. I also bought some lovely jumpsuits on the road. And the suitcase has been recovered on today. Yeah.
So happy ending.
Thanks for closing that loop for
That's
us.
That's actually the main question, like our whole, like forget the book. Been, like where's the suitcase?
Where is the suitcase? And the suitcase is being FedExed to us right now. Yeah.
Like you literally can't write drama like that, right? It's like a mystery, drama, love, you know? Will their marriage survive this?
Will our marriage survive?
It did. I can testify from just gentle observation.
We're okay. We're doing okay.
I have a question for Christine, and I was curious about this when we were talking earlier, but you're a publishing veteran, and you're a writer, and you made that jump more recently. Does that feel like a jump?
Totally.
Was that something that you were sort of hiding inside yourself? I'm very fascinated by... switching hats within a world.
No, she's so surprised that it happened.
Yeah,
she
no, it
never
is.
Expected this.
It's a real pivot for me. And it's very, it's much more different than I thought it was going to be, especially, you know, working in publishing for so long and I'm like such a publishing person. And, you know, I loved being an editor. So it was never something that I was like, oh, I'm, you know, ready to escape this or I'm going to do something different. I mean, I really loved being an editor. I loved being Joe's editor. You know, I published a lot of great books over my 20-year career. And I liked being behind the scenes. I really did. And championing other people's stories and work. And so it is a very different orientation to be really like in front of the camera, so to speak, right? And to and it's so much more like an emotionally taxing proposition to write a book. It really requires a lot of vulnerability in addition to the discipline. And yeah, it's people, especially when we were on tour for the first book, everyone was like, what surprised you most? I'm like, it's so fucking hard. Like, and they're like, you didn't understand that? I was like, not really.
That's so interesting.
She would send me an edit and be like, hey, here's like your
I'm
whole,
like, can you get this to me by Friday?
Can you just do this big thing in like 2 days?
And so now I have a lot more empathy for my writers, and I think it has made me a better editor too. I mean, I think being an editor has actually made me a better writer, just because
it has,
like doing it so much. Like I know how to structure a book. I know about pacing, momentum, like those kind of ornate things, because I've helped so many people do it. But I think the reverse is true too, in terms of like now I really understand the emotional component to it and how hard it is to like be on stage and sell books and say, you know, I hope you love love this, you know? I mean, that's like a really hard thing to do. And especially, we were talking about this in a podcast the other day, especially in our society today where we say, don't worry about what other people think. Don't compare yourself to people on Instagram. Like, turn it off. Stay in your lane. It doesn't matter. The only person who matters is you. Like, all these things, which are...
Those are lies. Dirty lies.
But they're healthy messages, right? Sure. Like, you want to think that. Yeah. But then when you write a book, all that matters is that people like it, right?
And you also can't...
It's hard to hold those two things.
And not stay in your lane because you literally have to be self-hustling.
Yes, you have to. Yeah, you have to be hustling. And that part is hard. So, I mean, I'm glad I did it and I feel like I do. The other thing I tell people, and I'm, you know, Joe and I talk a lot about talking about race as a hard thing to do and the way that we push through to the other side, we feel like constructive. The other thing I tell people is I started a different career deep into midlife, you know what I mean? Like I really thought I was going to be an editor forever and ever and ever and ever. And so the pivot I made is pretty dramatic and I'm glad I did, but I also like to say it as, you know, sort of an example of like, you can try new things. You can make a leap to do something different. And, you know, as scary as that is, I'm so glad that I did it. So it's just like a good thing to think about and a good thing when you see people doing it, it feels hopefully less scary. The same way like being child free by choice, when you see people that have a different, you know, like a different life, like I don't have kids and I want, you know, young women to see that that's an option too. Like it's, you know,
CFPC.
I'm trying to get this acronym
really,
to take off,
to,
and it's really,
CFPC.
It's not really working. Yeah,
so but
no, it's cool. I totally agree.
Because Alex, you wrote your first book. How old were you?
Yeah,
29.
I mean, yeah. Exactly.
The ripe old age.
It came out last month. I got to do a conversation with Alex last month.
Last month. Yeah, because my book came out on May 2nd, and Joe.
Were you guys sitting in different, Joe? You were sitting here and you were sitting
here. Yeah.
But yeah, no, totally. And I, you know, technically had been writing the book since I was quite young, but just couldn't get it published until now. So, but yes, that said, big pivot. And, you know, it's, I actually think, you know, there's a thing about late bloomers and I'm like, okay, it's less time to fail before you die. You know what I mean?
Like oh my God, I love that. Less time to fail before you die.
Writing is a slow process.
No. Yeah. Like, all right, we just created something right now.
It's a t-shirt,
but also an essay collection called "Less Time to Fail Before You Die."
Yeah,
and it's essays from late bloomers.
Yes. Oh my God, boom! Yes.
That's good. Yeah,
I'll do the podcast version.
I'll edit it. Great, perfect, and I'll write an essay.
Alex will write it and do the prologue and bring all the essays together.
Yeah.
Fallon, can we just like mark that down?
Kid Lindsay on the phone.
Woo!
That's
it. Yeah, I mean, like, it's such a slow, arduous process, you know, as we're saying. So I just feel like, okay, I'm this age. I have, you know, maybe another book in me, and then let's call it quits.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
I do want to give a shout out for Alex's book, Don't Call Me Home, because it is one
she's
of
been
best.
Raving about this book. I haven't had a chance
book.
To read it yet, and
no,
I'm dying
I mean,
to.
Just, like,
but especially
a
because
raw,
she just keeps
honest and heartfelt memoir that was also just so fun and funny, and I like laughed my ass off. Like I actually like snorted laughter.
Well,
thank a bunch
you. That's
while
my intention.
This. I know. I can tell that you want
and
me
it's
to
hard
snort.
To be
yeah,
funny.
It's hard
on the
to
page.
Be funny.
Yeah.
Especially like with memoir and going through like things that are really shitty, but you made me laugh about really shitty things. So her book is really just a gem, and you should
thank you so much. That's so generous of you to have me here and mention that. So I guess we've got the wrap-up thing.
Bon, you've got a question.
Yes.
Last question is the woman with the sleeping baby.
Yeah, she couldn't really raise her hand high because they're full.
So I'm just so curious if there was a moment of serious contention when it came to, Christine, your lived experience as a woman of color, when, you know, trying to provide perspective for both books, and like how you resolved that.
Yeah. There were many, not just one. I mean, it was hard. We had a really hard time, which is, again, we're honest about.
We've got some.
We've got some.
Should we talk about that? The one? The big one?
Yeah. I mean, talk about them all.
I don't know.
We'll be here all night. Yeah.
How much time do we have? Do we have any wine backstage, guys?
The big one. Yeah.
So it was We Are Not Like Them, which was a much harder book to write because it was the first time we were doing this together. And at the time, we keep saying this, we're like, we were relatively new friends. Christine had edited my book, but we were just starting to get to know each other. And when we say new friends, now we just kind of laugh because we're like, that was 8 years ago. Like, we were no longer new friends. But we were starting to sketch out the characters of Jen and Riley. And if you haven't read the book, it's a white woman and a black woman. They're lifelong friends. They grew up here in Philadelphia. Jen's husband is a Philadelphia police officer. Riley is a local newscaster. Hey, Nydia. And Jen's husband shoots a young black teenage boy. And Riley is the journalist who's assigned to cover it. And as we're sketching out these two characters, Riley's character started coming across as just too perfect. Like everything, she was good at everything. She was beautiful. She had this perfect, very normal, very healthy family. And my concern was that she wouldn't come across as relatable at all to readers on the page, mostly because I really enjoy writing like kind of fucked up women, like real women, right? Like we're all fucked up. We're all complicated in our own way. And so we started talking about that, and I was throwing out things that I had had happen to other characters in their lives. You know, did she have an affair with a married man at her last job? Did she have a teenage pregnancy? Are her parents divorced? Is there drug use in her family? All of which were tropes that I had thrown in my last novel that Christine edited, Charlotte Walsh Likes to Win, which was about a white woman, and Christine really pushed back hard on that, and I'll let her pick it up from there.
Yeah, it's just like we had a specific intention, and I very much had a mission-oriented intention that, you know, Riley be a character that we don't see enough of in commercial fiction, which is just a regular black girl, you know, who's mm-hmm. like doing it all, has a nice family, middle class, you know, that is not burdened by a lot of you know, pathological trauma that comes, you know, in a lot of story, mm-hmm. white stories about, you know, black people and mm-hmm. black characters. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Joe saw, you know, a little bit of equivalency between characters, right? Mm-hmm. It was a little bit like, well, why not? Because, you know, white characters do this all the time. Mm-hmm. And it was really a, you know, flashpoint conversation because, you know, it's like, it's not the same, right? It's not the same. There's an extra layer and an extra burden if you say, like, Riley's dad's a drug addict, you know, versus Jen's dad's a drug addict or whatever. And we were really trying to be so cognizant about pushing it back against these tropes. I mean, it was very intentional that Riley's family was the, you know, the stable middle-class family that actually helped, you know, Jen, brought Jen along, who had a much more complicated family life. And so, you know, we had, it got very, you know, intense. Do we need to bring the baby on stage? It got,
we might have to bring the baby on stage.
It got very intense. And, you know, in order to as we hashed out why this matters, you know, and it, this conversation even makes its way into that book because mm-hmm. Joe's like, it's not about race. And I'm like, everything is about race. Yeah. And there, you know, that's, you know, our whole shtick really is that everything is about race, you know, and it oozes into every interaction, every relationship when you have two people of different races or backgrounds. And so that was really important for us to show that. But it was like all those kind of little conversations, not really little, all those kind of big conversations.
They were really big that conversations. Had to, we didn't talk for weeks at a time.
Yeah.
There were
really,
years.
Yeah. So even because there would be like a tension,
there was
like
tension.
In the air,
in
the digital
yeah.
air. That's well, so interesting.
For sure.
For
yeah.
sure. And because, you know, as Christine said, I was like, this isn't about race. She's like, of course it's about race. And then I felt like I'd done something wrong. Mm. Or
oh,
that
that's
I
so
was,
interesting.
That
so
I was,
yeah, on
that
some
I was
level,
and then
you
I felt
were...
shame, right? And that shame, with that shame came anxiety. And I think that also ends up shutting down a lot of conversations
yes.
about race. And then, because then I wasn't talking more, Christine thought I was being defensive.
Oh,
and
boy.
We try
it
to
was
be
a
really,
spiral.
It's
that.
A spiral.
To, yeah.
And we try to be really honest about that when we're on stage, especially, you know, with groups that are either all black groups or all white groups yeah. or mixed groups, because we see people nodding a lot. They're like, yep, that shut down my conversation about race mm-hmm. and
yeah.
or that ended my friendship about race. And we're like, okay, well, yeah, it sucked. And we got through it. And we got through it by continuing to have the conversation and by giving each other grace. And we didn't have a choice. We were married contractually mm-hmm. at that point. We're
right,
like, okay,
right.
You've got to write this book. But we're really glad we did it.
It's so cool.
And
like that you, yeah,
yeah.
that you pushed through.
And we're
yeah.
better friends because of it. And we can now have these honest conversations with people who are like, oh, okay, maybe it doesn't have to be as hard as I think it is, right? Right?
Yeah, that's really cool. And like, I also feel like the one thing, like I don't want to end the night without adding this in because that subtleness is what I found the most interesting thing, you know, going back to the first book as well, is exactly what you say, because that is very reflective of Riley and Jen mm-hmm.
yes.
as well. because we all think, I feel like, as like, you know, progressive Philadelphian,
yeah,
you know,
let's be honest. I mean, we're people like at the free library,
we're on the same page. And that said, I know as a white person, I'm completely unaware mm-hmm. of the microaggressions and macroaggressions, you know, that my black friend is having. I'm totally in the dark about that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I loved the way you touched on it in that more subtle way. That's not like the Derek type
yeah,
person.
Yeah, exactly.
You know?
Right.
But then it's also good to see him as like
yeah,
the Derek
totally.
Type person.
Yep.
But then adding in that, I wanted to say that you also deal with feminism in this lovely way because you never like outrightly talk about it, but they mm-hmm. are both really feminist books.
Definitely.
And Jason had to bring
all
him at the end.
Back
Alex's
to
secret boyfriend.
Yes,
Jason.
At the end of the day is a hot yeah. misogynist on some levels. Yeah. And
hashtag hot misogynist.
Hashtag hot misogynist.
Yeah. And like,
well, come on, we've all loved a hot misogynist.
Definitely. Yes. You gotta have a little misogyny in there to spice things up.
This is gonna be the best podcast the Philadelphia Free has ever released, by the way.
But
there's some hot takes for sure.
You know, I'm gonna bring up another book, and this is a lot to bring up in the last minute. But I mentioned that Monsters book to you.
Monsters, of course.
Yes, a new book mm-hmm. by Claire Dieter. Monsters. It's mostly about men, male artists who do, you know, monstrous things, but it, mm-hmm. but it's much more than that. And anyway, she brings up, it'd be an amazing like co-read actually with your book because the last part of the book is about women monsters, but the word monsters is very loose because basically a woman monster is a artist woman who abandons her child.
Yes. Oh, yeah.
Oh,
no,
wow.
I hear that.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
So
that's
I'm just kind of throwing that out
there.
But I thought of it a lot while reading your book because obviously, like, you know, who knows whether Daisy's not necessarily an artist, but like, you know, men abandon their children all the time.
All the time.
Yeah.
Constantly.
Yeah.
All right, Nydia Han, last question.
Number one, I was struck by the pretty character and the judgment on her parents.
Yeah. Yes.
And I kind of felt a little sting, like, oh,
wait,
you're
the witch character?
My parents.
Pretty. Yeah.
Oh, I'm
pretty.
Just wondering how that whole sort of little side story evolved.
Mm-hmm.
And then secondly, did you talk about a third book? And can you give us a preview?
Yes.
Yes. All right, she snuck in two questions.
Yeah.
Sorry, guys.
Well,
okay. Yes, Preeti is, Cinnamon is a college career counselor at a community college. We also wanted to give her a very normal person job because people in books always have like fancy advertising
jobs,
or lawyer jobs. And we're like, you know, no one in real life has those fucking jobs. And so she's advising one of her students, Preeti, who comes from a very conservative immigrant background. And her parents don't agree with her relationship with a woman or her career choices. And Cinnamon, we did that very specifically. Cinnamon is actually kind of judgy of Preeti's parents. And we wanted to show that mm-hmm. everyone is judgy about someone.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone has their own biases. Like, no one is immune from it. It's not like only white people have biases mm-hmm. or only black people have biases. Everyone has bias against someone. And so that's why we wanted to show that in her. I mean, she has extreme judgment against Preeti's parents.
But also we wanted to show the different types of parenting too, and that Preeti's parents feel like they are protecting her, right? They want you to, you know, mm-hmm. they want her to have a good job, and they want her, you know, to have a conventional relationship, right? Because that is how you're successful in America, and et cetera, et cetera. And so we thought that, I mean, it's such a little tiny anecdote, but we're trying to, in each of these, pack a lot of punch in terms of all of the different dynamics of the way that you can look at something of who's judging who and what
and
is the background.
Caring for who and what does care mean and the different ways that we consider care. And yes, very quickly, we do have another book together and it is called I Never Knew. We use too many pronouns and it's really screwing
It's another string of pronouns.
I never knew you at all. And so in interviews, we're really like, all right, so yeah, we never are not you at us. Yeah.
We really set ourselves
really
up there.
We really screwed ourselves. If we do a fourth book, it's just going to be called Bananas.
Yeah, just like one word. That's it. I like bananas. We
bananas.
About that. Yeah.
Bananas.
You reverse engineer a plot
Go.
About race and bananas.
Yeah.
I'm sure it can be done.
Friendship and bananas.
But that book is about an interracial marriage. So it's a black woman married to a white man. And this white man was raised by his grandfather. And we learn at the beginning of the novel that the grandfather may have been participant in or implicated in a racial crime when he was a teenager some decades before. And this information comes to light through Simone's ex-boyfriend, no less, who has a podcast where he investigates these racial crimes of the past. And so it really asks questions of, you know, sort of how far have we come? How well can you know somebody? What is forgiveness? What is the statute of limitations for forgiveness? And so on and so forth. And how this marriage can navigate or survive or not, we'll see.
We actually don't know yet.
We have no idea.
That's interesting. So you don't know. Do you know the ends in every book or just this one?
We usually know the end. This book, we do not know the end.
Great.
Yeah, because Christine loves it.
Which is giving me hives. Yeah.
She
cannot like not know.
Oh, shit.
The
end.
Yeah.
She's freaking
out. I want to know the end of everything that's happening in my life at all times.
Yeah, I can see that
in my real life, you know?
And I'm like, it's all a mystery.
The first day I started dating the man I'm dating now, I'm like, what do you think is going to happen here? Like, where does this end up? Like, what? I know it's only been an hour, but let's game this out over the next five months, year, 10 years, and just like,
what's our plan?
What's
that didn't
so
work out
funny.
For you.
That makes a lot of sense. Okay, so then before we go, your book, your personal, you know, one author novel
takes place now
in Sicily and is coming out.
I've got The Sicilian Inheritance coming in April, which is a twisty, turny murder mystery loosely based on the murder of my great-great-grandmother in Sicily. And so, yes, that will hit in
April 2024.
I would love to see all of you at our launch party, which will definitely include a lot of Sicilian wine and cannolis.
Amazing. I'll be there. And Christine, we don't know exactly.
Oh, no, we know exactly what hers is. It's about her latest romance.
Uh-huh. Oh, okay.
It's called To All the Men I've Loved Again, and it's about...
Ooh.
Second chances, first loves, the one that got away, the one that gets found. Mm. So classic kind of rom-com territory.
Yeah, I can't
thrillers,
wait.
Thrillers, rom-coms.
Amazing. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you
it's
so much
wonderful.
For being
thank
such
you.
An
this
amazing
so
conversation
good.
Partner.
Thank,
thank you guys for your great questions.
Thank you,
we really appreciate
thank
you being
you,
here.
Philadelphia Free Library.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.